Thank you very much, and I appreciate that. You're going to have to give me just a second here. There's a flyer coming in, but folks, there are five different groups participating in this across the United States of America, plus the people right here in the room. So I'd like to give a shout-out to California and the Sister Thunder radio show, who's reaching the brothers and sisters across this nation. I'd like to give a shout-out to 42.org, who is just reaching everywhere else, as well as the RNN. So we're here. We're ready to roll. With me tonight is the guest, Gary Hunt, who has been the primary researcher on committees of safety that I've been talking about. I'll defer to him when we start with this. And like I said, I want to thank everybody who's involved in this, folks. The first thing I'm going to do is let you know that you can go to committee.org, that is committee.org, to read all of the history you're going to learn tonight and even more. Furthermore, you've got the Republic News Network that you can go to, and if you're listening to this show and you want all of this information, go to mtpatriot.net, that is M-T, Mike Tango, patriot.net, and contact me and I'll send you absolutely everything I've got. But I'm going to start out tonight with a little bit of why we're here. The audience is going to have to, I'm going to talk to the microphone and everything, but we're here because our government is killing us. We're here because we're slaves to a system. We're slaves to a court system whose whole purpose is to make profit. We're here because the government has overstepped its bounds by forcing us to buy medical care, has forced us to pay taxes, just incredible number of things that they have done to take our freedom away from us, and there's only one lawful and constitutional way to get it back. Now, we've all seen that you can try to play within their system, you can petition for a redress of grievances, and they ignore you. You can file lawsuits if you're wealthy enough, and they'll dismiss them with prejudice, so that you can never file them again. More importantly, what they do is they sue. And there's the big problem. The Constitution starts with the three words, we the people. What does that mean, we the people? It simply means that the government does not get to make the choices for us. We tell the government what it is going to do for us. They don't listen. So how do we compel them to listen? How do we get them to not seize our property without a Fourth Amendment warrant, Article 4 of the Bill of Rights warrant with two affidavits sworn to it? How do we stop civil asset forfeiture? How do we stop all of the incredible intrusions on our personal freedom? We now have, they are taking religion, the Christian religion out of school. And folks, I start by saying I'm not Christian, so I'm not going to go on that rampage. But we have the right to teach in our schools everything, but yet they'll shut down one religion and they make children write why the Prophet Muhammad is great. We have Sharia law being freely brought into Texas. That's a violation of Article 3, Section 2, Part 3 of the Federal Constitution. So what are we going to do? That's the real question. Because every time we try to do something, they demonize us, they shut us down, they tear us apart, they target us, and I'll be talking about that specifically later because I've got two confirmations of an event that's occurring here in Montana about that. But moreover, they just simply railroad us in a court of law. So what's the answer? Well, let's turn back the hands of time. Let's go back to our founding fathers and decide what did they have to do to stop the British crown. And that's where I'm going to ask Gary to come in and say a little bit about it. So Gary, first off, would you tell us a little bit about who you are, what your background is, so the people understand why you're a patriot?
Well, why I'm a patriot is I've believed in my country since I enlisted in the Army back in 1964. I've been writing for the Patriot community since February of 1993. I went to Waco on March 5th, didn't leave until April 22nd of that year. Was there through most of the siege and the burning, the murder of the women and children, men and women and children in the church there. I've continued writing for the Patriot community, doing various types of writing, many of them are historically based, and a lot of them are about events within the Patriot community, from Oklahoma City bombing, overflights of Nord Davis's property in North Carolina, Indian reservations in New York and Connecticut, and, you know, stories all over the country. I began a newspaper prior to Waco and went to Fax Network and then ultimately to the Internet. Fax is like the Pony Express. It disappeared. Back in 1993, I was back in Orlando, Florida, where I lived at the time, and I was in a bookstore and read something about committees of safety. And it kind of intrigued me because the role that they played in the creation of this country. And so I've continued to study committees of safety since then, every book I can find on it, and begins to put together a picture that our history books in the public school system or government school system have failed to teach us. Now, it's not necessarily taken out now. It's a long story why it was omitted in early history, even in the early 1800s, because they chose heroes, events, and dates as a way of carrying on the history, and it's kind of carried that theme all the way through. However, what I learned is that the First Continental Congress and the Second Continental Congress were both called by state committees of safety or local committees of safety. The Third Continental Congress in 1776 was perpetuated out of the Second Continental Congress. The committees of safety, as early as March of 1774, they were established before then, but as early as March of 1774 in Worcester, Massachusetts, the Committee of Safety declared independence from England unless England returned to the original Massachusetts Charter. When they did so, they forced the resignation of all the judges in the county. They got rid of the courts, they got rid of the militia. Then they reinstituted the courts to deal with criminal matters only. They reinstituted the militia and recommissioned the officers, excluding any Tories that were in the community. So we had them forming a government independent of the royal government in Massachusetts over a year before Lexington and Concord.
Now, before you go any further, Gary, let me ask you on this so the people understand. Did just a handful of people do this, or did the colonists themselves want to be free of the English rule or be restored to the original charter? Was this just one or two people, you know, wildcatting it, or did the actual people in that community want that?
Well, I wrote an article which really is a reader's digest version of a book. It's called End of the Revolution, Beginning of Independence. Worcester, Massachusetts is the first one that I've found that declared independence from England. However, when they forced judges to resign, history focuses on Boston. Boston was embarrassed by their being so far behind Western Massachusetts. Through most of Western Massachusetts, the committees of safety and the militia, or just armed people, went to almost all the courthouses in Western Massachusetts and forced the judges to resign. Now, at the same time, the Massachusetts Port Act, just 2 weeks behind the Massachusetts Port Act, was the Massachusetts Government Act. That Massachusetts Government Act assigned they were called counselors, new judges for the courts, removing the judges that were previously selected by the Massachusetts and paid by Massachusetts. The new ones were designated by England, and they were paid by England. So as many as, in one case, 26,000 people armed with staves or rifles went to one of the courthouses the first day of the court and forced the judges to resign their post. And with honor, they resigned, and honorably, they never tried to claim duress in resignation. They accepted the resignation. The ones that didn't resign fled to Boston and hid with the British and never returned to the countryside. So it was through Western Massachusetts we had this massive movement that had nothing to do with Boston. Boston had Gage and all these soldiers, I think 6,000 soldiers at the time in it, And so it was kind of a separate world from the west, rest of Massachusetts, which was rebelling against the Massachusetts Government Act, not the Massachusetts Port Act, which was the consequence of the Boston Tea Party.
Yeah. Well, see, I wanted people to hear that because I want people to understand it just wasn't one or two people. Here in Gallatin County, Marty Lambert and Sheriff Gookin love to say, oh, it's the freemen or just a handful of radicals or the quote-unquote sovereign citizens. Well, the first thing you have to understand about the word sovereign, it's in the Montana Constitution, Article 2, Section 2. It says we are sovereign. It says we have the right to self-governance. You just heard that 240-plus years ago, 26,000 people wanted the same thing that we want, accountability from the government. So go ahead, Gary. I guess one of the big questions that's going to pop up, and I'll let you kind of think about this, is this illegal?
Let me do a little more history first, because the English Heritage has a much older history in committees of safety, and the first instance I found was in the time of Cromwell. This is when Charles II ended up losing his head ultimately, but you had the Cavaliers and the Round Hats. What had happened is the king had taken extraordinary power. It was beyond the power that was granted at the time. There was a rebellion against it. So Cromwell and his people, who were in opposition to the royal government, wanted the militias to work for them instead of the government. So they established committees of safety in the 1500s and then delegated to those committees of safety, recognized those committees of safety as the civil authority that governs the committees of safety. Now, we can go all the way back to the Magna Carta, and in that we find that people armed have a subordination to civil authority always. And that character is carried through to the present day in our English Heritage. Next instance that I found any detail on in 1592, I think it was, the Governor Andros of New England was raising the quit-rents. There was a sort of a tax on the land. The land was owned by the crown, and he was raising the quit-rents, and he did it without parliamentary authority. So the people got upset over that. So some of the militias in that area requested the citizens to form committees of safety, and then once they were formed, they transferred their obedience to that civil government, the Committee of Safety, rather than Governor Andros. When they did that, they were still subordinate to a civil authority, and that civil authority said, arrest Andros. Andros was arrested, put in jail, until he was put on a ship back to England. In the settlement of Western Pennsylvania and Western New York, the Wyoming Valley, the Susquehanna River area, where there were Indian incursions all the time, especially after the French and Indian Wars, but even before, committees of safety were formed because the governments of New York and Pennsylvania could not provide protection of the people from the Indians. So they formed committees of safety. Those committees of safety then made sure that they had militia, they had the watchmen, a number of other positions appointed. They built stockades that people could go to if the Indians were coming into the area. So we have a Committee of Safety pre-Revolutionary War where the government could not provide the protection of the people through committees of safety over the militia provided protection for themselves. On April 12, 1775, if you go to committee.org, you'll see right on the front is a flyer from April 12, 1775. John Hancock was chairman of the Massachusetts Committee of Safety, I think they called it Provincial Congress then. It became Committee of Safety. On April 12th, he recommended that all plantations, all towns, form a Committee of Safety with at least three people so that they would have the civil authority that the militia would subordinate to. And we've all have a good idea what happened on April 19, 1775. There was a book written a couple of years ago by John R. Galvin. It's called The Minutemen. And in all of the articles that I've written read about the April 19, 1775, this is the only one, and it extensively deals with the relationship of committees of safety during that hectic period when we chose to take challenge the our government, the British government, with violation of the English Constitution and say no more. Kind of the same boat we're in today, except we haven't taken that final step yet. So that you can see the role of the committees of safety. As time went on, all of the provinces created a state committee of safety or provincial committee of safety. There's an entire book written by Agnes Hunt, no relationship to me, to the best of my knowledge, but she talks only about the provincial committees of safety. She doesn't talk about the counties. She makes reference occasionally, but the county and the town and even plantation committees of safety. So this structure built from the bottom up, the town committees of safety, the county committee of safety, the provincial committee of safety, and the Continental Congress. That was the bottom-up structure that created this country and allowed this country to go through a revolutionary war with never a loss of civil government. It wasn't a power struggle at the end. The government was already in place. They adopted the Articles of Confederation and ultimately the Constitution in 1789.
So this is what I wanted the people to hear on this fact was that we, the people, established the committees of safety because of a corrupt provincial governor, corrupt provisional manor lord, or whatever you want to call it. But this is just not something that's being dreamed up. This is not something that we're trying to institute now out of thin air, like Gookin and Lambert. And most sheriffs around this country and district attorneys will tell you, oh, you guys are just rebels. You're trying to dream this up. This is rooted in American history. This is American history. This is why we exist. So what I'm asking for the group here and the groups on the radio to listen to and understand is that we're not asking you to commit anything that is not American. I don't go past. You can go past the history of America back to the Magna Carta. But all I want to focus on is American history. You can understand where we got our knowledge from, why we did the committees of safety, but I want you to understand that we actually implemented a nation of committee of safety that ultimately became the Congress and the federal government through the limited authority of the Constitution, and that was it. So that's where we're at with this, and I want people to understand that where we go from here is strictly up to you. And that's where I'm having Gary explain, and that's why I popped that question out there. Is this legal? I mean, the short and sweet answer on it.
Well, one thing to think about, and I think I've alluded to it, we would not be the United States of America today if it were not for the committees of safety because of that transitional government. Now, the government they created, heed these words. The government they created, with few exceptions, the five crimes enumerated in the Constitution, their purpose was to govern the government and to govern that portion of the state governments where their authority extended. The Constitution never gave the government the authority to govern the people of this country until the 14th Amendment, where they began extending their authority down to the people.
And that's something that you need to understand. We are 50 independent republics. Why are we 50 independent republics? Because each of us in our state are the control of our very own government. We control the county. We control the elected people that we send to, in this case in Montana, it's Helena. And from there, we then originally elected our Senate, elected our people to go to the federal government. Now they've changed that process, but you still can't take the people out of we the people. So we've got to take back this country at this level, right here. Every county in this country, the 3,000 plus counties that are here, for those of you who are listening in California and Texas and Florida and New England area, we're here to take them back one county at a time because we can't take the federal government back. Not because we don't have the manpower, but because that's not the way the system works. The system works, you control your local area, you stop the corruption there, and then you help all the other areas around you do the same. And if the state government doesn't get the idea that they're here to behave and obey the people, then you remove them. And that's what this is about, how we're going to be able to constitutionally and lawfully remove the corrupt officials in our state and in every state in the union that's listening to this that really wants to take back the freedom of this nation. Gary?
Let's see. You mentioned a word earlier that I think often is misunderstood. The word is sovereign.
Mm-hmm.
When the Constitution of the United States was created, the people were sovereign, with the exception, and I'll get to that, of what they gave to the states. But we, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, when they created that more perfect union, that Constitution was a charter for the government to exist. It created the government of the United States of America. And in so doing, the people, and through their state conventions, delegated some of their sovereignty, or granted some of their sovereignty, to the federal government only specifically where it was granted. Likewise, when the state constitutions were created, and the original 11 of the original 13 were actually created before the federal constitution, likewise, they relinquished some of their sovereignty, but only that portion that's granted to the state government by the state constitutions.
Right.
But we've had a transition in our thinking, and the government school system is part of this. But there's a word that really bothers me when I hear it heard today, because most people think of the word public as meaning the government. If we look back to what public meant in 1828 when Webster wrote his dictionary, it's the body of the people. It's not the government. It's the body of the people. That's the public. It is not the government. So when there's a public park, it belongs to us. All the government is they're custodians to take care of it. When we talk about the public land, like, for example, a ranch in Nevada that's had some problems with this, that public land belongs to us, and their job is strictly administrative. It's not to write rules and regulations that say we can't use our land. But the encroachments by government, especially since the 14th Amendment, are continual, and they keep expanding their authority over the people.
Right.
And, it even comes down to what toilets we can use and what light bulbs we can use.
And it goes further than that. But we're going to go to the heartbreak that they talked about at the beginning of this. So we're going to pause for a couple of minutes for station identification, basically, and then we're going to be right back. So if you're listening to this, Kelby, please take over. We're going to mute the microphone here.
Huh? You are ready to go.
I appreciate that. I appreciate all of those who are still listening to us and going forward. You have to understand the history of where we came from before you can understand where we're going to go. You have to understand what our founding fathers and every soldier who has ever fought in this nation, died for this nation, every family who has sacrificed one of their children, one of their fathers, their brothers, their mothers, their sisters, we have to be able to understand where we were before we can move forward. We truly have lost the view of ourselves and our government here, because we believe through the brute force and through the absolute corruption of our education system that we, the people, can only do what they tell us. We can only petition for recall. We can only ask them to review a judge. We gave up our right to a citizens review board of law enforcement agents thanks to the John Birch Society, and they're very proud of it and put it on their webpage. We used to have control of our life. We don't anymore. And that's what we're here for, to discuss how we're going to take this back and how we're going to do it peacefully. And that's the big key, because, folks, there are only four ways, there's only four boxes we can use to take back any government. And this is for any government in any nation. We can use the soapbox, which is what we're using right now, and we should always use that. We can use the ballot box, but with 18,000 dead people voting, with the Gallatin County administrator here for the voter leaving out two critical votes, or two critical offices off the ballot, with just multiple fraud and Acorn and going all over the place, we don't have a good ballot box system. The third box we have is the jury box. Now, some of you are going to cringe about that, but I still believe that when you stand up and tell a jury that in 1794 the first jury nullification of a law occurred, and that in 1906, and mostly if you look in your state that you're in, folks, you'll find these laws on the books or these rulings. In 1906 in Montana, the State versus Koch, it was clearly stated that the jury has the right to find you guilty or innocent and the validity of the law. So you can always challenge any law, seatbelt laws, Obamacare, egregious taxes that are not equal and fair. Any law can be challenged in front of a jury as long as it is you're charged with a crime. Because, folks, that fourth box, that's the box we really don't want to open unless absolutely necessary. And that's called the ammo box. Our founding fathers had to do that. And that's what I'm trying to avoid. Now, Gary, you want to go ahead and move on forward with this?
Yes. There was a question in somewhere that somebody posed to me. And let me see if I can find it. And I think it kind of crosses the bridge between history and today and might be noteworthy. Can't find it. But he asked, wouldn't everybody be arrested if we went to arrest the judges? Back then, there wasn't a police force. You know, there's a question. Roger Root wrote a very interesting essay on our cops constitutional. Phenomenal, because he goes back in history and sees the whole concept of police force that we have now is not constitutional. It is, in essence, a standing army. But back then, the British had 6,000 troops in Boston, and when you've got 10, 12, or 26,000 people with rifles or staves going down to tell the judges to resign, the British aren't even going to send their meager force out against that force of colonists out in the western Pennsylvania. However, today, if you went to the courthouse to force the judges to resign armed, you would have battle-geared police, MRAPs, no telling what you'd have surrounding the courthouse to keep you out. So times have changed considerably since then.
Before you go any further, I want everybody, most people in Montana know what I did with the Ernie Tatalga case, where I went to arrest Judge, Judge West. I believe it was West. Yeah, it was West. Judge West, Rick West. Not only did I speak with the FBI, not only did I speak with the sheriff, I didn't go to jail over it. Because in Montana, according to Title 46, Chapter 6-502, you can arrest any citizen. In your state that you're in, you probably have citizens' arrest laws. And if you read them, it says you can arrest any citizen. Well, last I looked, the judge was a citizen, so you can arrest them. You're still going to get what Gary said. They're going to come at you with every angle. I mean, if you go to my YouTube page out there, which I did a poor job of putting it up, but it's still there, Sheriff Gookin calls us a disease because all we wanted to do was hold them accountable. Yeah, let me tell you how powerful that is, okay? So all of you listening out there across the country, the four justices of the peace who could have heard the case in Gallatin County recused themselves because they were afraid of being arrested, and they brought a judge in from another county. The man got a fair trial and was found not guilty by what? A jury. It is possible to do this, folks. You just have to have something that the New England Patriots didn't have, and that was, we're not going to go there. But what you really need to do is understand, everybody, this is possible to do. And if we have, like in Gallatin County, there's 90,000 people. If we took all the adults in Gallatin County and they stood together like the 26,000 did, guess what? I think Sheriff Gookin would still be in his house having morning breakfast, and the judges would be escorted out, or the U.S. Marshal's Office, or the military police, because they're still lawfully able to take custody of a prisoner in this country. Under the NDA Act, you might as well use it against them as well. We have tools available to us that doesn't require us to draw a gun. The one tool that we have to have, that nobody seems to have completely, is the courage to do that. And that's where we're trying to hear with the committees of safety, to create a body of people where we can know that we've got your back and they've got your back, and we can go force these corrupt officials out of office. And that's where I wanted to go with that. So you go ahead, Gary, if you've got more to go.
Well, on the history, just to understand the significance of the committees of safety, the role they played in creating our country, and did they occur again in our history? Yes, because it was just about 140 years later, 150 years later, down in a country called Texas. Actually, it was part of Mexico at the time. And they formed committees of safety. And on committee.org, you'll see an entire section devoted to the Texas committees of safety. So we see that the Texicans saw that there was a problem with the Mexican government because they weren't abiding by their constitution. So they formed committees of safety. They were in charge of the militia. They elected a government. They created a government just like they did back in 1774. They created a government, and they had a smooth transition from Mexican rule to Texan rule of Texas. And then ultimately, the committees of safety, I don't know if they were abandoned immediately after getting rid of Mexico or after admission to the Union, but that transitional state in Texas was based on the same concept that created this country. So historically, we can see the presidents from Cromwell to the wilderness areas of New York and Pennsylvania to the Revolutionary War, and even in the Civil War, where the South had committees of safety that took care of the home guard because the government in Richmond was too busy with other things. And then we have, before that, Texas in 1835 or thereabouts. So there's a history of well over 300 years of committees of safety in our heritage. You know, that's us. That's where we came from. We evolved from that. We've evolved too far away from it, but the evolution away is quite similar to the ones that were faced back in Cromwell's time, back in the time of the wilderness areas, in the time of the Revolutionary War, in the time of the Texas Revolution, and even in the South during the time of the Civil War, where the government cannot do its duty based upon the document that created the government, then the people have every right, the Ninth and Tenth Amendments to the Constitution have every right to do what is necessary. They retain the rights and they have the authority to deal with government themselves. Now, the question over whether committees of safety are legal or not arises quite often. Let's make it simple. Read the First Amendment, read the Second Amendment, read the Ninth and Tenth Amendments, and you will see the right to assembly. What are we doing? Assembly. Freedom of speech. We're speaking out about what needs to be done to protect us where the government fails to protect us, or, if necessary, to protect us from the government. The right to keep and bear arms and the right of militia. As long as it's subordinate to civil authority, it meets the historical definition of militia. And then the Ninth and Tenth Amendments speak for themselves. We have not given up the rights that were embodied in the creation of this country. In fact, let me find an interesting court case. Go ahead, speak for a minute.
While you're finding that, I want to read something from the Montana Constitution. And folks, in every constitution in every state in this nation has something exactly similar to this. All political power is invested in and derived from the people. All governments, I'm trying to read off a cell phone, so give me a minute. All governments of right origins with the people is founded upon their will only, the will of the people, not the will of the politicians, not the will of the sheriff or your local elected or your district attorney, and is instituted solely for the good of the whole. So it's for the people, by the people, of the people, for the people. Now I'll read you part two that most people skip over under Montana law. This is under the Declaration of Rights, and folks, Nevada is the weakest of all the laws, but it is still there. Self-government. The people have the exclusive right of governing themselves as a free and sovereign and independent state. They may alter or abolish the Constitution and form of government whenever they deem it necessary. There's no clause in this Constitution and in all constitutions but Nevada that say we have to ask the government's permission to dissolve a local government. That's what a committee of safety would have the power to be able to do if the people, this is not just three people saying we want you out. This is the people of the committee going to the people, the body of the people, and saying, is this government still good? And if the body of the people say no, this is the power that I'm trying to bring to you here and to all of the states who are listening to me, because every constitution has it in there. And that's what's critical to understand. The constitutions still have it, which means that they know we have the power. And what's going to happen? When we try to attempt this, they're going to do everything they can to stop us. But the ultimate statement that you have to ask every one of them is simple. Please recite your oath. I swear to uphold the Constitution of the state of Montana and the United States of America. At that point, everything after that is dribble. For those of you who served in the military, it says, I swear to defend the Constitution of the United States of America from all enemies, foreign and domestic. There's a little period there. End of statement, end of sentence. Anything after that is dribble, because if anybody gives an order that is not constitutional, you don't have to obey it. And that's what our politicians have forgotten. Well, they haven't forgotten it. They know it quite well. So in order to keep us from enforcing it, what do? They put a star on somebody's chest. They give him a gun and some body armor, maybe a Tinker toy tank, and say, go out and harass the citizens when they start to stand up. We can't have these uppity people standing up and taking our control away. Gary, did you find your article?
Yes. Domestic enemies. Why would they put that in there? Well, perhaps this will explain it. A well-known Supreme Court decision that has a number of elements, some of them misunderstood, but one without question understood quite well is Marbury versus Madison, 5 U.S. 137, decided in 1803, just less than a little more than a decade after the creation of the new government. What Marshall said in the decision, certainly all of those who have framed written constitutions contemplate them as forming the fundamental and paramount law of the nation, and consequently the theory of every such government must be that an act of the legislature repugnant to the Constitution is void. Now, we've all heard that. I want to go a little bit further. In 1787, now the other constitutions, states had created constitutions back in 1776 at the behest of the Continental Congress, with the exception of Rhode Island and Connecticut, who retained their charters but removed royal references. All the other states created constitutions. They had some problems with them, and they weren't as sophisticated. So a lot of what came in 1787 out of the Philadelphia Convention was an understanding of some of the failures of the state constitution and the adaptions that have been applied to those constitutions to make it more secure. In 1787 in North Carolina's constitution did not have a Fifth Amendment. Equivalent to the Fifth Amendment. So the legislature had, it did have a comparable to the Fifth Amendment. In a case called Baird v. Singleton, 1 North Carolina 42, 1787, but that it was clear that no act of the state legislature they could pass could be by any means repeal or alter the Constitution. Because if they could do this, they would at the same instant of time destroy their own existence as a legislature and dissolve the government thereby established. So you got that. If they could do this, if they could violate the Constitution with their legislation, they would at the same instant of time destroy their own existence because they were authorized by that into existence by the Constitution as a legislature and dissolve the government, the entire government that was created by that constitution, because it breached the contract to the people.
Well, what's important?
Interesting concept, if you think about it. We created the federal government, our forefathers created the federal government that charter, the Constitution, created that government. And if they breach that Constitution, the authorities, if they usurp authority that's not there, if they take away our rights, anything like that, they breach that Constitution, they have, from a legal standpoint, from a lawful standpoint, they have ceased to exist.
And this is pointed out in Marbury versus Madison. People hate that because that was supposedly when the courts took over our Constitution. But inside of that little statement, there was a little statement by John Marshall, Chief Justice, that said all courts and federal departments and government departments must obey the Constitution, which just support what Gary was talking about. Marbury versus Madison was very clear. The Constitution is the premier law of this United States. And if you write a law that's valid, invalid to it, that is repugnant, it is void. We've got civil asset forfeiture. We've got the school system. We've got Department of HHS. We've got Department of Homeland Security. None of those fall within the purview of the Constitution. And yet, they could take your children away from you. The courts can deny fathers the right to see children. They can destroy family lives. They can deny you the right to justice. In the state of Montana alone, it clearly states that in custody cases, there is no trial by jury. But yet your children are taken away from you, which means they have accused you of a crime, which means according to Article 3, Section 2 of the federal Constitution, there is a jury trial. So all of Montana family law is invalid because it is repugnant to the fact that you get a trial by jury. Not part of the amendments, but the actual Constitution as established. So all of these family courts that are destroying the lives of children and families who are going into homes and like they did to the pastor down in Missouri or wherever that was, and they took all his seven children because he had a natural herb in there that was not a controlled substance. That's unconstitutional. That's where committees of safety can come in to stop that kind of stuff, because you can remove those forms of government. When that government comes in and violates the base sanctity of the family with a bad law, it is void. And Chief Justice John Marshall said that, and as much as people has hated his decision, 212 years later, it has never been successfully challenged. Why? Because it says the government has to obey the Constitution. And who is the Constitution? It's absolutely every person in this country, because it starts, we the people. Nobody really goes much further than that. But it says ordain and establish. Establish means to birth it. We gave birth to it, and to ordain it means to bless it. We blessed this government, not of the United States of America, as they're trying to rewrite the school books, but for the United States of America. They are subservient to us, and if any law they pass is void, if it violates the Constitution, and this is why I want to bring committees of safety forward, because if they are invalid, like Gary was just talking about, because they violated their own rules, they have no right to rule us whatsoever, and we have the power to restore our constitutional republic through these committees of safety, and this can be for every state in the union. Not one state, even Nevada with its weak personal rights, so the Article 2 that I was reading, they still can do this. So folks, this is where you've got to decide where you're going to be strong at, and if you're going to really stand up and challenge them, because they're going to come back at you. And like I said, before the show's over, I'll let everybody know exactly how they're coming at us here in Montana. But anyway, Gary, next.
Well, where do we want to go now? I think we've covered the history and the concept of committees of safety and our relationship with the federal government and the supreme law of the land that we are expected to go beyond obedience to, and the government is expected to ignore obedience to.
Right. They want us to get down on their knees and kiss their butt. Folks, we're almost at the top of the hour. I promised another hard break to the radio stations. If the other radio stations who are listening could go ahead, come back on, unmute yourself. If you have any questions, we'll take them after the hard break. But could you go ahead and do that, Kelby? I enjoy, folks. I laugh at myself all the time because this is some very serious and heavy stuff that we're facing. This is what our founding fathers, when they sat in the Constitution Hall and they were writing and they were sitting down, and when they sat down and put their names to that Declaration of Independence, this is the weight that they felt. They knew they were dead. Fortunately, most of them got to survive through this and helped keep this constitutional republic together, even in the very beginning days when it was challenged. That's a heavy load to bear, folks. I have people who want to fight this fight, but they will tell me, like, I don't want to risk my children. That's a heavy load to bear. I have people who will tell me, I can't afford to lose my home. I can't afford to lose my business. Well, I'm here to tell you, you've already lost it. It's already not yours. You're just working for the government. You get to keep a small portion of what you do every day, and they get to suck it out of you. And you don't get to challenge them. Well, you do. Actually, you do get to challenge them. But, buddy, you better be ready for the fight of your life. With committees of safety, that fight just got a whole lot easier. That 300-pound gorilla in the ring just turned into a little chimpanzee. Because with committees of safety and the people backing them, here's what will happen. The people will say, we no longer believe your form of government, your law enforcement, and your courts are best serving us, we the people. And we're going to dissolve you. And you've got three choices. You can comply, which is one of your favorite words. You can resist, which I don't highly recommend. Or you can leave the state. Those are your only three choices. Because if you leave the state, great, we'll reform a new government, right based back on the Constitutional Republic. If you resist, we outnumber you 50 to 1. And I'm going to tell you how I know that they're scared of us. Or you can comply, because it's we the people that own this country. Lock, stock, and barrel. Every grain of dirt has been paid for with the sweat, the blood, and the tears of Americans for 240 years. You better bet your ass we own this country. So, folks, let's move forward with what we can do and how we can form these committees. You ready on that?
Before we do, we were talking about the authority for the committees of safety, and I overlooked one. I apologize. This is probably the strongest one because this is the one that created us. In Congress, July 4, 1776, the unanimous declaration of the 13 United States of America. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Now, interrupt here. All the previous declarations, and there were over 90 prior to Jefferson putting pen to paper, said life, liberty, and property. He wanted to be a little more poetic, according to the research, so he chose pursuit of happiness instead of property. Keep that in mind. Happiness and property are equatable in this context. That to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. That whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. Prudence indeed, this is where we are right now, prudence indeed will dictate that governments long established should not be changed for light and transient causes. And accordingly, all experience hath shown that mankind are more disposed to suffer, while evils are sufferable, than to right themselves by abolishing the forms to which they are accustomed.
Again, right what we are.
But when a long train of abuses and usurpations, pursuing invariably the same object, evinces a design to reduce them under absolute despotism, it is their right, it is their duty to throw off such government and to provide new guards for their future security. So that pretty clearly says that talking about committees of safety and doing whatever is necessary, by any means necessary, to reestablish the Constitution as the law of the land and limit the government to the limitations imposed upon it by the Founding Fathers is our duty. It is our right. It is our duty. And committees of safety were the means back then of achieving that, and they will be the means again if we can get our act together.
And that's the point where we're fixing to move into, is how do we get our act together? Because the key word out of the whole thing, if you took everything out of that, there's one word, and that's duty. Whatever right you think you have is unimportant. Your duty is to this Constitution until you decide to leave this country and yield all of that for another nation. This is what every soldier understands. This is what every person who goes into the military understands. They may go in initially for some other reason. They may have been forced into it through the draft. But by the time they're done, they're over there bleeding and dying and missing their families for one reason. Duty. Not because somebody put a gun to their head, not because there's a higher ranking officer ready to put them in the brig, but because somewhere in their heart they said, this nation is worth dying for. It is our duty to ensure that their sacrifices haven't been done in vain. Question is, are you ready to do your duty? So teach us, Gary, teach us a little bit on how we're going to bring these forward, if you don't mind.
Well, consider also that what the founders did with the Declaration of Independence, when they said our duty, they imposed upon us the obligation to make sure that what they created continues as the great experiment as was intended by them. Okay, now, how do you form a committee of safety? The consent of the government is the probably the most important phrase in that, in terms of where do we go now? Have you given your consent to the TSA, the DHS, the imposition of restrictions on all kinds of things in our lives, the fact that the Constitution says that Congress will receive compensation for their services? Compensation for their services would be like a salary while they're in office, but instead they've got lifetime gratuities, they've got massive expense accounts that the previous, if we go back 100 years, they didn't have these. Everything came out of their pocket. Abigail Adams was concerned about the state dinners and finally got Congress to participate when there were state dinners in paying for the cost of the food. Most of the salary, and this happened to not Roosevelt, damn, I can't think of who it was. Anyway, his wife had the same problem in the early 1900s. How do we pay for the cost of you being the President of the United States? It cost us more than you receive in salary. And now we've got $6 million pizza trips and million-dollar flights to Hawaii on a regular basis. These things are beyond the compensation that was intended by the founders, and what we have done is we have created a royal class of people with the lords and ladies in Congress and the monarch in the White House. And though the term is only 4 or 8 years, we have still created a monarchy where he has untold wealth at his disposal, and that wealth is coming out of our pockets. So that consent of the government becomes the key element. And if you realize that you have not consented to the government going beyond the limitations imposed by it by the Constitution, you have every right to form a committee of safety. Now, back in Orlando in 1994, we created a committee of safety. We had a meeting. I had arranged for space in the library, downtown Orlando Public Library, and we had about 300 people show up. And I explained committees of safety to them. Now, this is what, 20 years ago, 21 years ago. I explained the concept of committees of safety to them then. Of those people, 80 decided that they wanted to join the Committee of Safety and create it. So the first step was I was not the leader. In fact, I intended to leave Orlando. And they said, well, why don't you be the chairman? I don't want to be the chairman. I shouldn't be the chairman. I'm just helping organize it. So they elected a chairman and then started holding their meetings. And I left shortly thereafter. Another one that I helped set up was South Bend, Indiana. Dave Leeper was the principal in organizing it, but the same thing was true. Everybody wants George Washington to come back. George Washington might be sitting right beside you, but he's not in Washington. He's not somewhere else. He doesn't wear Republican or Democrat on his collar. If you create a committee of safety, you get people together, and then they elect their officers. Now, historically, it appears that the term of office was 1 year, and I think that's a pretty good deal. You know, you can go out and come back in, but you don't become perpetual. You don't become a power broker. You don't become such an influence that nobody can resist you. So the terms were 1 year, but you gather the people that want to form a committee of safety, and then you elect the chairman and other officers, secretary, treasurer, vice chairman, to hold the role of the chairman in his absence, and that becomes the functioning body. Now, there's a concept that is kind of hard to sort out, and I think back then they used different forms for the Committee of Safety, but Albany, New York, for example, where I've got from 1775 to 1781, the entire minutes of that Albany, New York Committee of Safety, they appeared to have two bodies, a general association and an executive committee. The executive committee met on a regular basis. The initial general organization had, I think it was 126 members, but you've got these seven or eight people being the executive body. On occasion, they went to the entire body to vote on a matter, but the administrative, the daily work, the correspondence and everything was handled by this little executive body of seven or eight people. So it was tiered where you've got an executive body that can make some decisions, but any significant decisions have to be made by the General Association, which is the larger body. So with that in mind, a few years ago, they wanted to set up a state committee of safety in Arizona, and we established the Arizona Committee of Safety. The problem was the guy that I was assisting in setting that up said, we'll have five county committees within a month or two. We never did get in the 4 months of its existence. There never was a county that joined in. And we realized that you really can't start at a state level. You need to start at county level, city, town, county level. And then when you have three counties, maybe then form a state committee, because this has to be built from the bottom up. And if we look at building it from Arizona down to the county, those people apparently didn't want to subordinate to these people that were already on the state board. And I can understand that. We built a transition into it. But in the process, wrote bylaws for the State Committee of Safety and wrote bylaws for an organizational plan for the County Committees of Safety. And those are available in a zip file that's on committee.org. There's a file that's just chock full of information, historical documents and everything that will give you an idea of what the concept of committees of safety was then and how we've adapted it to modern times. So all you need is three people ready, willing, and able to start a committee. It's better to get more.
Let me get back here again, folks. That's committee.org for those of you who are listening. I've got some of the information here. Matter of fact, I've got all of it. I passed some of it out. They give you examples of how the bylaws work, how to set it up, and how to move forward. If this is something that you're really serious about doing, if you're serious about taking back this government, you need to visit committee.org, because the modifications from when he started doing all of this and from when our founding father started doing this, we're now in a modern age where I'm speaking to a couple of thousand people right now across this country, hopefully more. These committees of safety can be almost instantaneous. The decisions can go out on a Facebook or on a tweet if there's something that needs to be done, and you don't have to wait so long to get decisions. This can be something that can go overnight, I mean, within moments. So what you need to do is get your people together who are interested in this, go to committee.org, download that zip file, and it's all right there. It's laid out. You don't have to do anything but make some minor modifications. But you've got to find the courage to do it first. And this is to everybody out there. Folks, you really need to do this with all of the things going on in this world right now. I'm going to tell you how bad it is. And I'll let you get back to it in a second, Gary. I have a friend in Croatia that I play a game online with, and we chat quite often. For the first time in the history of Croatia, the new president sent out a letter inviting young men to join the military. Sound like Vietnam to you? It's exactly what it is, folks. This world is in a mess. And if we don't establish ourselves here in Gallatin County, and in every county that's listening to my voice, if we do not start and have some form of government ready when we have to kick this other government out, this de jure government or whatever they want to call themselves today, the bottom line is we're going to go into chaos, and they're going to bring in DHS, FEMA, pick a letter. Won't matter. They'll bring it in. So you're either going to be proactive, or you're going to attempt to pull off a Red Dawn. You remember the old movie, not the new one, where they fought back in the Wolverines and all this? I'm going to tell you, it ain't going to work. Because once they lock your butt down, it'll be worse than the Jews of Germany and Russia during World War II. And you'll just be a slave. So keep going, Gary. I'm sorry. I just wanted people to understand how serious this whole world is becoming, and why if we don't start focusing and finding our way to do it now, you better break out the fourth box or learn to get on your knees. Go ahead.
A couple of concepts behind Committee of Safety that I think are important to understand. First one, on December 12, 1774, that's 4 months before Lexington and Concord, the delegates from the various committees of safety, the deputies, met at Annapolis, Maryland. They came up with some resolves, and one of them is very significant. It says, "We do most earnestly recommend that all former differences about religion or politics, and that all private animosities and quarrels of every kind from henceforth cease and be forever buried in oblivion. And we entreat, we conjure every man by his duty to God, his country, and his posterity cordially to unite in defense of our common rights and liberties." That was Maryland. It wasn't Massachusetts, and it was in December of 1774. The other one that it needs to be understood, and some people on Facebook today had raised this question, and I've heard it raised before, committees of safety are not an advocacy group. They are an executive and quasi-legislative body. They don't support a candidate for office in the existing government. They're the antithesis of the existing government. They're there to fill in the gap where the government fails to protect us. They're there to supplant the existing government if the need arises. But they are executive and quasi-legislative bodies, and in that respect, they do not participate with the existing government. They're not obedient to it. They don't need permission to exist from it. One guy down in Arizona tried to create Arizona Committees of Safety Limited Liability Corporation, which would be approved into existence by the Secretary of State of Arizona. That doesn't make sense to me. Not that you're opposed to the existing government, but you're creating one of the bodies guaranteed in Article 1, or Amendment 1 and 2 of the Constitution and 9 and 10 of the Constitution. You're creating a body to fill that gap where the government fails to provide the protections that should be afforded in accordance with the Constitution. That transition into the hostile element comes only if the government decides that we don't have the right to protect ourselves, that right of collective self-defense that existed all through our history. And so those two concepts need to be understood. One, that we have to put all our differences aside, or at least make them subordinate. I wrote another article called Factions, and it explains it. The principal faction is restoration of constitutional government. It doesn't matter what group you're in, as long as the principal faction, we all abide by that restoration of constitutional government, it doesn't matter what other factions you might belong to. But if that's not your principal faction, you're not a patriot, because that solves all the problems.
And that's the key that we've been trying to stress here on this, and we'll get to some questions and answers shortly. The bottom line is, whether you're black or you're white, male or female, whether you're Christian or not Christian, your first duty, there's that big key word again, is to the Constitution. You'll always have duty to your faith, okay? But that's between you and your Maker. But the duty to this country of the flesh and blood that you are is the duty to that Constitution, so you can have a duty to your Maker. Because without that, without that constitutional republic, you will end up like China, Korea. Pick a country in which the people do not have the power to put a foot in the butt of government. That's what these committees of safety are. So all the little personal quibbling that's there, the black, the white, the baggy pants, the non-baggy pants, the white man did this, the black man did this, it's gone. If you want to restore our constitutional republic, that has to be buried with a stake in it, simply because we're not going to have a way to go back. And this is what I want to get forward to. I want to take some questions shortly, but this is something you're going to have to decide. Committees of safety don't stand on the side of the road and protest. Committees of safety take the information and they tell the government what to do. And that's where we're going to start with. I know that's a little modification of what you've put forward, but the only way to move a government to comply is to have a threat. Well, we can have the threat of the fourth box, which I don't want to go there, or we can have the threat of the jury box, which every time you get a ticket, you should go there, whether you're on committee of safety or not. But the biggest thing that you can do is get them out of office by exercising your right to recall, because you don't need their permission to recall. You can do it as a people. If the body majority says, we're done with you, you're out, you do it. And then you get the body to go down there and help them pack. If they don't want to do that, like I said, every state has the right to dissolve the government. And the first county in the country that dissolves its sitting government, dissolves its legislative body, its former county or city commissioners, dissolves its law enforcement body, and dissolves its judicial body, that will be the beginning of the peaceful revolution, unless they want to make it a war. But then that's fine, because it's game on, and they will have started it, and the militias will finish it. But this is not about having a militia to go out and take this over. This is about you telling your neighbors, getting them involved in this, not as a political group, not as a rah-rah group, not as a petition group, but as, we're done with your horse crap, let's get it out. And that's where we're at with that. So anything you'd like to do before we open this up to some Q&A?
Yeah, I want to address what you just said. Let me go back a little bit. October 2013, there was an incident in Washington, D.C. that was rather interesting, and I wrote an article called Resistance Has Begun. Strange. It wasn't until October 2013 that resistance had begun. They weren't carrying signs that day. They carried barricades and dumped them at the White House. That was the first act in defiance of government. Subsequently, April last year down in Nevada, we went from civil disobedience. Civil disobedience is where you might get arrested, you might get hit over the head or pushed to the ground. Civil defiance, back to the end of the revolution, beginning of independence in western Pennsylvania or Massachusetts, civil defiance is when the risk is greater. If you've got guns on both sides, the potential for violence exists. That's what happened in 1774 in western Massachusetts, as these people resisted the intrusion of the federal government, the denial of their constitution by the federal government. If your county commission, for example, is going to enact an ordinance, if you're going to go to that meeting to try and affect it, you don't go in and saying, we don't think you should pass it. You go in saying, you have no right to pass that. You have to be so firm in your conviction as to impose upon them an obedience to the will of the people. So you're not being political. You're informing. You're advising them that we will not tolerate you enacting ordinances that are contrary to the Constitution. And that is a subtle difference, but it is the difference between obedience, disobedience, and defiance.
And that's critical. We just saw Ferguson, Missouri, where the people peacefully protested. And how did the police meet them? They greeted them with body armor and assault weapons. That escalated the situation. Had there been a committee of safety there, they could have ordered the police to go away, and they could have backed it up with the force of the Constitution. And that's where you've got to be. You've got to find that courage. You've got to move forward. And this is where we're going to have a problem. If you do not have the conviction, if you do not have the heart, you're already dead. Let's not play the game. Let's go home, watch the Super Bowl, have a beer, and not worry about what the government tells you to do, what you can do with your children, how you can vaccinate your children, how you can educate your children. That's what it is. There's a question. We're going to open this up to Q&A, if that's okay, Gary?
Okay.
Yep. Kelby, if you've got questions, time to send them into the chat room, because I've got one already from a person who contacted me today because she saw the YouTube. This is how powerful social media is.
Yeah.
Go ahead and get
your question answered. When you guys are done with your questions, we'll open up our Q&A over here and see if anybody on our line wants to ask a question, okay?
So the question was, what I really want to know is how I legally, quote, lawfully, establish a constitutional republic within my country. Well, you already have one.
Within my county, not country.
Oh, yeah, county. I'm sorry. Can't get my glasses.
you're not creating a constitutional republic. The Constitution created, at this point in time, 50 republics. And then a union of those 50 republics called the United States of America. So the republic exists already. The problem is neither the state nor the federal government is recognizing what Article 4, Section 4 of the Constitution does, and it's the only guarantee in the Constitution. It guarantees every state a republican form of government. However, I'm going to use the example of same-sex marriages, that a number of states, Alabama and California are two I'm aware of, when propositions are passed, they are amendments to the respective constitutions, and they both banned same-sex marriages by proposition. In both states, the federal courts have overturned the will, the republican form of government, the right of the people to amend their constitutions to limit marriage to one man and one woman.
There is no...
So the republic is there. It's just not... The state governments will not defend their rights under the Constitution. Some people call it a states' rights movement. It's not. It's a constitutional movement. But the concept behind committees of safety is you create one in your town or your county or a number of towns in your county and then create the county committee of safety. You're not creating a republic, but you're saying don't go here. Now, I wrote an article called The Plan for Restoration of Constitutional Government. It's rather lengthy. But basically, somebody asked me to simplify it. We've got a map of the United States, and it's all black. But a little white dot pops up over here. And that's where people in their town have returned to the Constitution. They've convinced the city council or displaced the city council and said, we're constitutional, and we're not going to allow anything in this in our geographic area that's in conflict with our the state constitution. No federal intrusions, nothing. And slowly that'll grow. But there's another dot pops up over here and over there and all over the country, all these dots pop up. They begin growing. And eventually a couple dots merge and they keep growing and eventually they take over the entire county and create a constitutional government. And somewhere in that state, another one will occur and it will get to the county level. We're building from the bottom up. And this is about what happened back 230 years ago. And so you're not creating a constitutional republic. You're creating a constitutional geographic area by removing the non-constitutional impositions that have been placed on the community by the federal and or state or county or city governments. You're removing them.
That's the key right there. My constitutional republic that my founding fathers left me is just fine. It's a little flawed, but that's what there's an amendment process for. The problem is the bad actors in that government. And whether you're talking about the federal government with the clown in the White House or down here at the local government with three clowns on the county commission, the government's fine because it's a constitutional republic. You just got to get rid of the clowns in the seat. And that's what the committees of safety are here to do. They get rid of the clowns in the seat, get rid of the clowns in the black robes, and get rid of their jackbooted thugs in the law enforcement. So all law enforcement listening to this call, and I know there's some doing, I have no issue with you being peace officers, but when you violate the Constitution, you are an enemy of the Constitution. You better go home and think about that long and hard in the mirror because you're part of the problem. So let's get to the next series.
You called me. Let's use the break right now, or can we go about 10, 15 seconds?
Go 10, 15 seconds. That's fine.
Yeah. Okay. The term I like is usurpers. Usurp means to assume authority that you don't have.
Good term.
Usurpers are the bad guys. The three. That's the one we need to use. That's the one the founders used. Go to break.
We'll go to break, and then we'll get right back to questions. Is that what you wanted to do, Kelby?
Yeah, just take about a minute to 2 minutes, and I'll see you guys back on the show.
There's a question that was stated in here, and I'm going to try to paraphrase it. In Gallatin County here, where I live, we have a sheriff's department last year that took in $1.2 million in profit from housing prisoners. Now, for many years, they've been trying to get the taxpayers to pay for another prison so that they can house more people and make more money. The people have said no. The bottom line is that the sheriff's department has gotten about 40% of that, if I understand right. Well, according to the meeting that I was at, they talked about how he was going to spend his $500,000 in profit, the one meeting we went to. And guess what? How do you make $500,000 on profit on prisoners? And why aren't you answerable to the people for it? This is what committees of safety are for. All of those people who have been harmed by the sheriff making profit can come to these committees of safety. These committees of safety can take that to the public, and they can remove the sheriff. And that's kind of a broad statement, but you've got tools and resources to you that are... You've got the recall process. Most people go, Montana's recall is so weak. No, it's not. It's actually very strong because it says the only format you have to follow is a clerical one. The county attorney doesn't get to determine what you put in the 200-word limit. The county elections officer doesn't get to tell you whether or not you can bring this suit, but they do. And this is why we need a committee of safety, because when they deny you that right, you have to have recourse. They've denied you the first tenet of the Bill of Rights, the right to redress grievances. Judges dismissing cases with prejudice so that you can't ever sue them again when you're the harmed party. Committees of safety have that power to establish an order, not a petition drive, not a little banner waving drive, but a signature collecting process in which the people say, this is corrupt, this is wrong, you're fired. And then they serve it to the sheriff or to whichever elected official. And if the elected official fails to obey, then you dissolve the entirety of the government in that county. Because if one official will not support the right of the people under Article 2, Section 2 of the Constitution, get rid of them. This is what the committees of safety are going to have the courage around this nation to do. And I'm sure that if you look around your county, your city, and the state that you're in, you will see this kind of corruption going on. Now, some have had some success, like in California, where they actually brought back a citizens review board to do what? Review the sheriff and the city for their criminal activities. Citizens, you and I. a committee of safety. Whether you call it a citizens review board, it is the same thing. It is a committee of safety. It should be a committee of safety as a governing body so that you can remove that corrupt sheriff when he violates your rights, or the corrupt judge who takes away your freedom of speech, or the corrupt politicians who pass laws. That is what committees of safety do, but you've got to have the courage to realize you're going to stand up to these clowns. You've got to go out and talk to your neighbors and get them involved in this, because if it's just you, you're an irate citizen and nobody's going to listen to you. If
this
you
is
get...
why I'm talking to my neighbors right now.
Right.
On Tuesday, I'm going to be at the county commissioner meeting at 9, and I'm going to ask for a citizen review board.
No, let me correct you. Don't ask for one. Tell them you are going to establish a citizens review board, or we're going to establish a committee of safety to remove you. Don't ask. Tell. This is the thing that you've got to get inside of your head, America. We've been trained to ask. Please, may I have some more? Please, may I drive on the roads that I pay for? Please, may I teach my children to pray? Not going to happen anymore.
You didn't need to demand the review board. You need to demand that that you have access to all evidence, and you need to demand that you have subpoena power to investigate.
Demand. That's the key word. Kelby, do you have a question? Or do you have one of your listeners with a question?
I could open up our Q&A if you don't mind, ladies and gentlemen.
Please.
We're going to open up the Q&A right now. In the process, to ask a question, you simply press *6 and the number 1 on your phone. Again, press *6 and the number 1 on your phone, and we're going to hold and let these guys talk while the questions come in. Go ahead.
All right. Look, folks, you've got to be part of this. I could talk all day long, but talk doesn't get anywhere. We've proven that with the government. If you have a question about where we need to go, what we need to do, it's time to ask it so we can get all the minutiae out of the way so that when you walk into that commission meeting, you walk in with the power knowing that you're going to demand what is rightfully, constitutionally yours. And when they give you gruff, you go, great, you don't want to obey me? We're going to get a committee of safety, and we're going to force you to comply with the Constitution, Article 2, Section 2. That's what it is. They are our servants. And if you don't put a foot in their butt, well, yeah, I'm going to be polite. There are children and ladies present. Kelby, did you get anybody coming in on this? I know there's a lot of people.
We got our first caller to come in. It's area code 262. Again, if you have any questions, press *6-1. Press *6-1 on your phone, and you'll come on in a queue. Again, area code 262, you have the floor.
Good evening, everybody. This is Daniel Flores. I just wanted to ask, first of all, I want to say thank you for everybody being out here, and I just appreciate it. My question is, does these committees, do they have to have an oath of office, everybody that is in there, not just a spoken one, but an oath of office in written form, showing that the people are behind it and that it is a lawful movement? And I'd also like to make a statement. Any of the judicial system that is before us, de facto, they do not have an oath of office. This has been established. They won't admit to one, and they refuse to show their credentials. So, that being said, I'll answer the question.
In the zip file at committee.org, there are a couple of things in there. One is the oath of secrecy. It was an oath similar to what you're talking about. It was, you know, what do we do today? We could make up our own oaths, but using the models of history, at least as a foundation. There's also a subscription form. Actually, there's two subscription forms. One does not recognize the ratification of the 13th Amendment to the Constitution, the real 13th, and the other one does. The one that does recognize the ratification of the 13th Amendment does not allow anybody who is in law enforcement or a banker or other people who have accepted titles of nobility, which is titles of privilege, actually, from being members of the Committee of Safety. They have excluded themselves just like certain people under state statute are excluded from militia. So there's two subscription forms that you would fill out to become a member, and then the oath of secrecy that was taken by the General Association in Albany, New York, is in there, and what their oath of secrecy requires is that anybody privy to the dealings of the Committee of Safety will not divulge anything that happened within the committee meetings except in a court of justice, not a court of law, but a court of justice. We used to have courts of justice in this country. Now we have courts of law. There's a big difference. And hey, that's what they did back in 1774 with the Massachusetts Government Act. They took them away from the people where they were courts of justice and made them the king's courts. So only in a court of justice can you divulge, violate your oath. Well, you're not violating your oath. Does the oath exempt you from the prohibitions of disclosing business within the meeting? Is there an oath to the Constitution, which was actually created by the Constitution? I don't know if any of the state constitutions had similar oaths or not, but bear truth, faith, and allegiance to the Constitution, that would be a good one to include. But each committee has to decide what it wants to do. When you get to the county level, you throw your heads together and come up with what you want to do, and share what you do with other committees. We're learning history that has been omitted from the history books, and we've got to piece it together with the intention of pursuing the same course of the founders and improving it if we can.
And that's the key to it. We have history to teach us, but what we have to do is make our own history today by establishing that every officer in the county, every judge in Montana, and in most states, every politician has to swear an oath. Everybody who worked in Congress swore an oath. I would see it as no less. But then again, that's up to you and your committee of safety. And eventually, when everybody begins to form them, when they start uniting in one, as one in a state, not as one big assembly, but as independent committees, but having the same format, this is where you're going to have to put aside your differences. Those of you who like cattle and those of you who like sheep, you're going to have to put them aside because the Constitution is more important. Did that answer your question, caller?
Daniel, 262.
Yeah, basically, I was muted. I apologize. I still, you know, I would assume that probably the smartest way to go about it would to swear everybody in with an oath. I don't know, see how you can go without it.
Well, see, that's something that you could bring to your own committee of safety. That's something that you should bring to your own committee of safety. And let me tell you, if everybody starts swearing an oath to uphold the Constitution, well, it's going to be common practice. So sometimes
I will say that some of the oaths that I've studied historically, there was one that was rather interesting, and it basically said that if I violate this oath, I accept that I have committed treason and am subjecting myself to the penalties thereto, which means that, you know, if you violate the oath. Now, it wasn't a Committee of Safety oath. It was, I think, a militia oath. That was taken somewhere. So we've got models in history, anybody who wants to start a committee of safety, I'd be glad. I'll share what I've got. It's all shared in that zip file. I'd be glad to help you in trying to develop something, or you can do it on your own. But when you do it, if it works, if it's viable, share it with other committees of safety so they can use it or improve upon it.
We appreciate your question. Do you have any others, or do we have any more callers on the line there? Kelvin?
Danny, you good to go, or do you have any other questions?
No, I'm good. Thank you.
Thank you,
for being part of this historic event. I appreciate that.
Let me kind of give a little refresher here. Back then, committees formed in different manners. They had different different rules, different bylaws, different procedures in all these states. That I find ones in North Carolina, for example, they're completely different than the Albany, New York one. The ones in Western Massachusetts were even different in their imposition. For example, in that book, The Minutemen, one of the counties required for the militia to leave the county, they had to get permission from one of the officers of the Committee of Safety. It took 7 hours to find the guy, so they're at the county line waiting for permission to go to Concord or Battle Road, where others went right away, whether they got permission from the Committee of Safety or not, but we also know that Rhode Island, Connecticut, New York was also sending their militias down, whether they had consent for the committees of safety or not. That right of collective self-defense might have been overwhelming, where they felt they had an obligation to go without consent. So we're in the same boat today, but it's easier for us to share because of the internet and even U.S. mail. We've got better means of communicating what works in establishing committees of safety. But we've got to reinvent the past, using the past as a model, but adapting it to modern times to make the best of the circumstances, to make the best use of history, and to reaffirm our rights under the Constitution of the state and the federal Constitution, so that the government relinquishes the power that they have usurped from the people, both state and federal.
Thank you, Bob. We do have a question from our host, Bob. Bob, go ahead.
Yes, I had one come in to me here. Many of the grand jury effort nationwide, and he wonders, why is that different than a committee of safety? You're trying to hold them responsible either way.
Because a grand jury...
Let me take this one, Walt.
All right.
When we relinquished part of that sovereignty that I mentioned earlier, both to the federal and the state constitution, if you look in the state constitution, more than likely, the people relinquished to that government the authority for a grand jury. And the statutes over time... at the outpost-of-freedom.com/library, all lowercase letters, you'll see an essay on grand juries from 1908 or thereabouts. But the grand juries used to belong to the people. They've been taken over by the U.S. attorney, the state attorney, the county attorney, and people like that. They dictate now where the foreman made all the decisions in the past. It's been relinquished back to the government representing the public. But it was relinquished. Now, Committee of Safety, on the Committee of Safety page, you'll see the Committee of Safety has the common law court. But if you read about it, like I think the first one I'm aware of was a guy named Judge Wapner many years ago, but you got Judge Judy, Judge Napolitano. Arbitration, if both parties agree, it works. But the grand jury issues indictments. And the person that's accused has a right to answer and go to petite jury for trial or not answer. And the grand jury then issues an unanswered indictment. But it doesn't make the person guilty. It's strictly probable cause. Now, the grand juries back in the 90s, and I think the National Liberty Alliance and these are trying to model it after that, they cannot determine guilt. And I was in Columbus, Ohio, attending one of these, and they're railroads. They're not weighing evidence. They're just taking words and building a case out of it. So if you want to conduct grand juries, you have to have evidence and probable cause only, and that's the error I see in what I see, and I haven't looked into all that are being proposed right now, but we relinquish that authority, and until we're ready to take back that authority, which is where the committees of safety come in, by growing those white dots and taking over the county for the county grand juries, the state for the state grand juries, and eventually, well, the plan for restoration of constitutional government proposes something that's called the citizens grand jury, where a certain number of people petition as accusers, that any member of the government can be as the subject of a grand jury investigation. But we can't just assume the authority. Courts enforce their edicts. How do they enforce their edicts? With guns. And until you're ready to enforce your edicts, you're just playing like you're play acting.
See, that's the big key here, folks, with that. And I think that's something that you need to see. Committees of safeties are not grand juries. They're not there to handle indictments. They're there to present a secondary or a primary form of government when the restoration has to occur. But because these local governments, unless there is, you know, in Gallatin County where there's 90,000 people, if 40,000 people stood up a voting age and said, you're done, you're out, there's no grand jury needed to do that, but it is a committee of safety needed to review the evidence, to move it forward, and to enforce the will of the people. This is not about a court. This is about the people using their right to remove, and I'll use your word correctly, usurper. And that's what we're looking at here. The Committee of Safety has to be available to take the position of we are the interim government when we decide through the voice of the people to kick your sorry butts out of the chairs. And that's where we got to go. Does that answer
your question? If your grand jury comes back with an indictment, there's even though you can't enforce it, there's nothing. A radio talk show host can make a judgment about politicians. A Committee of Safety Common Law grand jury can issue an indictment as a statement of our belief this guy's bad. They can print tens of thousands of copies and hand them out to show how bad this person is. But that's the extent, that they can publish the results of their study into the illegalities of the actor that's the subject of the grand jury. So it can serve a means by that process of indictment.
And that's the beauty of the Committee of Safety and the involvement of all of the public, because when 10,000 people get those letters and they agree with it, that's a mighty statement. That's back to the first box, the soap box, and then you can move forward. Did that answer your question?
Well, he's not on, but I think you guys have done a good job.
All right. Is there more?
We do have a question from 42 Action, Randy Shannon. She was asking, do you guys expect them to exert force when we stand?
Do we expect them to exert force when what? I didn't hear that last part.
When we stand.
Oh, yes. I mean, throughout, like I said earlier, throughout the history of this nation, in the history of this world, no government has peacefully resigned power. They've always had to have the threat of force or the use of force to remove it. And I bring this up now because I've had two independent statements on this today. Here in Montana, TSA Viper teams have now arrived. Are you familiar with what the Viper program is? Any of you?
No, affecting all travel.
It gives them the right to perform searches and seizures of your vehicle with no warrants, with no probable cause. They can effect arrests upon you. They control the flow of traffic, and you have no rights under the NDAA Act. You lose your constitutionally protected rights. They can take them away, but the only way they can do it is because they've got brute force. And if you have a committee of safety in your community and you know that TSA's Viper program is coming here, and folks, I saw this 2 years ago here in Gallatin County in the summer of 13. I saw a man on the side of the road on his knees with his hands behind his head, his car completely stripped open, and you know who was standing there? Not the Highway Patrol, not the Sheriff's Department, but two gentlemen that had TSA hats on and TSA jackets. How does it feel to live in Nazi America? Because that's exactly what you're at.
Let me see if I can answer that a little more directly. The government created in 1789 passed on to posterity an obligation to maintain that government. I've got children and grandchildren, and I'm concerned about them. I was brought up in a country that was free. You know, post-World War I was the heyday of Americanism, freedom. You could swim if there was water. You know, it wasn't a police state. We sold lemonade. No, the cops would stop and buy the lemonade from us instead of closing it down. But for our posterity, we have a choice. If we're committed to restoring constitutional government in this country, are we going to back down if it becomes difficult? Are we going to back down if it might become deadly? If we do, we're passing a greater problem onto our children almost insurmountable by their generation, and by our grandchildren, possibly completely insurmountable, where everybody will be chipped, every move they make, every penny they spend will be monitored by government. Our choice is for our children, for our families, for our posterity, just like it was 200 years ago. And if we aren't willing to make the commitment of whatever is necessary to restore constitutional government in this country, we have just told our posterity, we don't give a shit about you. Now, you have to decide to what extent you are willing to go. There's another article I wrote called The Other Not-So-Thin Line, and it might be worth reading because it's 30 years of my observation of the Patriot community. It's a perspective that I haven't seen put on them before, but I think if you read that, you will begin to understand that I am further along than you, because I've been watching for a very long time, and I know that it will probably result in bloodshed. My concern is to minimize the bloodshed. But the government, if they resist our efforts to restore the Constitution as the law of the land, they will provoke us into taking whatever means necessary to restore that government.
But I remind you how we opened the show with the history and how 26,000 stood and how the British wouldn't even bring out their troops of 6,000. If in Gallatin County, and you take your county and just do this math, add up all the law enforcement agents in your county. Gallatin County, there's only 250 law agents, including Highway Patrol. If only 2% of the 90,000 or the 90,000 stand up against the 250 law enforcement, that's 1,800 to 250. Even the Chinese will tell you those aren't good odds. So what you have to ask yourself, and this is for Randy, if you have enough people behind you through your committees of safety, I guarantee you the cowards that these law enforcement agents are won't even come out of their armored vehicles, and then they are ineffective. And that's what you have to understand. This is a matter of gathering the 26,000 people, like they said in the earlier part of this program. You're going to have to convince your people that in numbers they're going to be safe.
Now, that's not hypothetical, because think of last April when perhaps 50 to 100 BLM soldiers, because they had administrative staff, they had medical staff, they had communication staff, but say 50 to 100 armed BLM agents, they had snipers on the hill, the guys down at the wash, and others standing around, but the Patriots had hundreds. Now, then if you saw the video at the gate when Dan Love said, well, we'll let Mr. Bundy come in, somebody pointed their finger at him and said, no, you will leave, and they left. No blood was shed, but the force of the people, the will of the people, the first act of real civil defiance in this country in a long time.
Yeah.
Was applied that time, the government backed down. Can we back them down to complete restoration of constitutional government? I'd like to hope that it is possible. But if we're not committed, we cannot achieve it. Without that commitment, at whatever cost necessary, or to the last extremity, which was the term used back then, if we're not willing to make that commitment to the last extremity, whether we have to use that extremity or not, we are not, in our own minds, fully committed to the objective.
Gentlemen, we've got about a minute left to go. If you have any closing comments, Wolf.
Well, first off, I'd like to thank everybody who came together in this attempt to bring this broadcast across this nation. I know it's been a little difficult, and I appreciate all the strength and effort that was there to make this happen. But the bottom line is simple. There are 350 million Americans and 7 million government agents. You do the math. Form your committees of safety. We have the availability to help you through that. Go to committee.org. Gary is willing. He has said so. I'm here to help talk and to help lead. But if you don't do it, I can't win this war by myself. And we are at war for our constitutional republic. I thank you for bringing this together and running the boards. I know it's been a slight nightmare, but Kelby, thank you so much. And thank you for the Sister Thunder Show for listening and 42.org and all the other groups who came together on this, because I appreciate that and giving me a voice.
And let
Wolf,
me
we want to thank you for coming on. Go ahead, Greg.
Let me simply say that I hope that these last 2 hours have been educational. You've learned something, and you realize that there is a solution to the problem, and that if we pursue it, we can achieve the objective. Thank you for
Absolutely.
Coming.
Absolutely. Thank you, gentlemen, for coming on the phone call. I'd almost like to have you guys back on the call, too.